In this episode, I speak to four wonderful women, including film journalist CC Peng. Here's CC on Rose Glass's Love Lies Bleeding.
I actually interviewed Rose Glass and we just had a really fun conversation and kind of talking about the phallic symbols of guns versus like the vaginal landscape with a crack in the earth. And she was completely like, yeah, this is exactly how I saw it, which was really fun to see when you see it come together in the film.
I also review the latest releases with film critic Rhianna Dillon and talk to two of the women who founded Cinema for Gaza and brought the film community together to raise hundreds of thousands of pounds for charity. Please note that this episode contains discussions about domestic violence and war.
Fasten your seatbelts. It's going to be a bumpy night.
I'm going to get that gun of mine and I'm going to change you from a rooster to a hen with one shot.
Some people call me a freak. I hate that word. I don't believe in it. Better yet, I don't believe in labels.
You know, I think you're the only girl in the world that can stand on a stage with a spotlight in her eye and still see a diamond inside a man's pocket.
Because I'm up at 5 every morning working my ass off. Does someone want to just tell me to my face you're never going to give me the scores I deserve?
Hi, I'm Anna Smith and welcome to Girls on Film. My first guest is a regular on the podcast. She is the BBC's Rhianna Dillon.
It's really nice to be back on.
Yeah, what have you been up to? How are you?
I'm good, thanks. I've just come back from a month in America, which was insane and amazing and one of the best holidays I've ever been on. Because we finished in LA and Mike, my husband, has never been before to America, full stop, actually.
Wow.
And so in LA, we had to, because he's a horror fanatic, as you know, we had to spend like one morning just going around all the houses in LA that have like featured in Halloween and things like that. So it was quite nice actually to have a little bit of a film day. We went to the Academy Museum in LA as well.
So you two on your holiday did film stuff still. You're such film fans, right?
Not the whole way through. Well, we didn't actually watch anything, but we did go and pay homage to, you know, a few little filmy areas. Mulholland Drive.
I would have to do that too. Yeah, fair play. And now you're back and you're on the film beat for Six Music again and all that stuff.
Yeah. Six Music, yeah. Five Live. I'm starting on Katie Piper's breakfast show on ITV.
Oh, great.
Doing some film and TV stuff there. So, yeah, it's back straight into the thick of it.
Excellent. Well, thank you for joining us to chat about some new current releases. We're going to start with an Italian film which has been absolutely huge in Italy. C'è ancora domani, There's Still Tomorrow.
Beautiful accent, Anna.
Grazie. It's been distributed by View Cinemas, which is unusual in itself, so loads of people are going to get to see this, right? I'm going to give you the difficult task of summing this film up for the listeners, Rhianna, because it's a lot of things, right?
It's a really tricky one, and also because there are these quite big plot points, which obviously you don't want to kind of give anything away, but essentially it's about a woman, a mother and a wife, which I wouldn't normally describe someone as, but that is her sort of existence as she's an abused wife. She gets, like, even in the first scene, we see her being hit. She has sort of quite a tempestuous relationship with her daughter, who she absolutely loves and adores and wants the best for. And her daughter is, is kind of, I think, quite disappointed with her mother.
Yeah, because she's of a distant generation, isn't she, I suppose. So, yeah, she's sort of feeling like her mum's, why are you trapped in this, in this relationship, yeah.
It's set in post-war Italy, in Rome. So I think it's maybe 1946, and it's shot in black and white. And it is essentially, and this, you know, this woman, Delia, she has male attention, but she doesn't, she kind of has to just focus on her husband and her family and all the little jobs that she does. And frequently she kind of comes up against these obstacles, which are always about the men, whether it's she's not getting paid enough because she's a woman, or whether it's her father-in-law who treats her, you know, like a skivvy, or her husband who, as we said, just sees her as somebody to hit and make his dinner. So it's quite a heartbreaking portrayal of a woman, and yet there is something incredibly hopeful about this film.
Hai visto gli americani quanto sono belli, oh? C'hanno tutti I denti, ma tanti, più di noi, ne sa.
It's co-written and directed by the lead actress, Paola Cortellesi, and she's tremendous, isn't she? Because she's a well-known comedian in Italy, I believe. And I think she brings such humour and heart to it as an actress as well as a director.
Se posso sapere perché questo è il primo giorno via più di me.
Quello è uomo, no?
Alla fine dei conti, lei è una brava donna di casa.
Perché me le va dalle mani?
Lui è poi meno sempre. Se no si abitua. Una.
Ma forte.
How would you say she achieves that balance? Because it's quite tricky, as you say, it's about domestic abuse in many ways. Mm. But yet there are moments of levity and real warmth.
I think what she does is, I mean, it's incredible that this is her directorial debut because, yes, you say she's been an actor and a comedian and a writer for a long time, but to set something in the past, in the 40s, in Rome, which has changed an incredible amount, and also to do it in black and white and to make it this subject, I just think all of these things must have been a real challenge, and yet it is such an accomplished film. And I have to say, because sometimes I feel like you can paint quite a bleak picture, so I'm really glad that you've kind of brought up the fact that it is funny, because it is a blend of genres. I started it and it was maybe like the day after I got back from holiday, and I was incredibly jet lagged, and I watched 7 minutes and I just couldn't. I had to stop it and then go back, then the next day restarted it, or later that night or something. And I'm so glad I did, because it just take a minute, because actually once it's, because I thought I can't watch 2 hours of domestic abuse, and actually it's so much more than that, because there are scenes which do, you know, it could be really quite violent, and she turns them into a dance number, for example, or she makes sure that the camera is not showing us anything, or she does this technique at one point where you see the bruises sort of literally melt away in front of our eyes. So she's playing with form and genre all the way through, and especially the musical stuff is kind of surprising but brilliant. I mean, how inspired to do something which still really kind of hammers her point home, but equally kind of gives the audience a little kind of moment, even to smile, which you sometimes feel really guilty. Did you feel that, like kind of a bit guilty about, or laughed,
yeah,
you know?
Yeah, I definitely, the bits you're talking about where she makes it into a dance, I thought was really bold and also quite unnerving, because you're questioning your own reaction, thinking, why should there be beauty in this horrendous moment? But I think the point I came away with from that is, as you suggest, that we've all unfortunately seen many times on camera that, you know, the really violent domestic abuse scene, which is really grim. Mm-hmm. And I think in a way she was paying tribute to this woman's incredible resilience somehow. And also saying, I'm not going to dwell on this, but I'm going to let you know that it's happening. Mm-hmm. But I thought for me, the sort of uplifting elements were a story of incredible resilience, but also, without spoilers, you know, people eventually, when you look at the younger generation, they're not accepting this kind of fate, or at least they're trying to rebel against it. So it's about change. And it's also about female friendship as well. There's some really lovely female friendships and support in this. So I would recommend this to people, and it sounds to me like you would also.
I absolutely would. This works for all generations, I think, but also for teenagers in Italy especially. This must be such a vital film. I had the chance to interview Cortellesi, and she was saying how Italy feels quite backwards in its politics when it comes to gender specifically, and I think this had the ability to kind of upset a lot of people, and yet so many more were the ones who went out in their droves to see it because they felt like this was a really necessary film. So a film that marks change in a country is such a huge deal, and I hope people don't sleep on this just because it's not exactly the same here, because it's still an incredible movie.
And it's still relevant, right?
Absolutely.
Still extremely relevant, and just a beautiful piece of filmmaking. And how great to see a celebrated Italian female director making this kind of neorealist black and white film that you know, that we know of a genre that is much better known for its male directors. So
yes,
exciting stuff. There's still tomorrow.
Sono un po' dei mesi che mi rubo qualche sordo dai lavoretti mia.
Non ho capito come rubi, sto I sordi tua.
Ci sta la posta, è per voi.
Pensa ai figli, pensa a Marcella.
Io proprio a lei che penso.
And you've also seen the Fall Guy, which is coming out May 2nd. This stars Emily Blunt, Ryan Gosling. He's a stuntman who's drawn into a secret spy plot while trying to reconnect with his ex, played by Emily Blunt. And how wonderful, she's a director of films, which I rather likes.
and a blockbuster director as well.
Exactly.
Very, very rare.
And Adam Wanningham as a producer. And I just struck me as how actually rare it is you actually see producers full stop, let alone female producers in Hollywood films, you know, Hollywood comedies. But that's the girls on film angle. There's a whole other angle, Rihanna, which is how entertaining is it?
Oh, it's so much fun. I love this film. And to be honest, I think there are quite a few issues with the writing of it, the plot maybe. But it's one of those films that genuinely falls by the wayside because you're having so much fun watching it. It did help that I had had a few espresso martinis before I saw this. But like Ryan Gosling's charisma, I think, is currently absolutely unmatched as a movie star, as a male movie star. I think the fact that he... so far seems quite unproblematic. I think it kind of makes it
please, fingers crossed.
I hate saying that because I've always proved wrong whenever a man's involved, but touch wood, he genuinely is a movie star that you feel like you can rally around. He genuinely feels like an ally, and so you kind of feel quite happy to see him do incredibly well, be as successful as he is, and to be as funny as he is. I think the humor in this between Emily Blunt and Ryan Gosling, and to see Emily Blunt be really goofy is really nice. I think she does goofy really well. I mean, obviously he does, but I think seeing Emily Blunt do quite a lot of horror recently, and we know she's very good at drama, and kind of taking her back to the like Devil Wears Prada, which isn't, you know, out and out goofy exactly, but very, very funny. I just think they clearly had so much fun on that, which just emanates from the screen. And also there's a stunt dog. I thought you'd be into that.
Oh, definitely. Yes, yes. That's one to consider for the Fido Awards, definitely. Yeah, there's a stunt dog that only answers to French and is issued instructions on a regular basis and gets quite a bit of the action. Yeah, very strong dog action here. And going back to Emily Blunt, yeah, I think she's so great at comedy. I loved her in Jungle Cruise. I think, so I think she's really good at those kind of meet cute, old, in a way, old fashioned romantic comedies, which this is. So The Fall Guy, yeah, not perfect, but I fell for it.
Oh, I love it. You wrote that. You wrote that in
advance. No, I literally just came up with it. Honestly,
well done.
I'm that good.
That was very good.
Thanks, Yana.
Anyone but him. I didn't approve him. You know that.
You are literally the last person on earth I want to see.
Slap the shit out of you. I really could.
And I'm open to that in a safer environment.
There's another film that we've both seen, which we're just going to touch on briefly. I would say this is a very straightforward film, but I was moved by it. Ordinary Angels.
Yeah, this isn't a film that I would normally sort of go out of my way to see, but I'm quite glad I did. It's Hilary Swank playing a woman called Sharon who hears on the local news or in a newspaper that a little girl, 5-year-old girl, is in desperate need of a liver transplant. And Sharon herself is going through, she's an alcoholic, but not really admitting to it. She's estranged from her son. She needs something. And this becomes her something. And thank goodness it did, because it is inspired by a true story. And Sharon becomes the woman that sort of makes things change for this family who do not have any money. You know, they're kind of crippled by their healthcare bills in America, which this is also about.
I've owned 4 small businesses. I'm good at plenty of things. Taking no for an answer ain't one of them.
Daddy's no for his head.
You're asking us to reduce the family's medical bills due to hardship.
No, I'm asking you to erase them. All of them.
Was that funny?
Hilary Swank in the lead role, I just think she's so much fun. I mean, she's got real like Erin Brockovich energy.
Totally.
She's just really, I love, because it's 90s and it's Kentucky. So she has this brilliant drawl. She's a hairdresser. She has great like kind of bouffant hair. She's got fringe cowboy jackets. I just like, again, talk about having fun with a role. And actually, because it's inspired by a true story, it could have been quite dry. I think she brings so much charisma and fun to an otherwise quite sad story.
Yeah, it's a real tearjerker, and I would say that if it wasn't a true story, you'd think, oh come on, you're really manipulating me here.
Yes.
But because it was true, and all everything that they basically say played out, it is an extraordinary story. And I was very moved, and it is, you know, from the Girls on Film perspective, the story of an ordinary woman who decided to do something absolutely amazing, and through her absolute sheer tenacity and refusal to take no for an answer, she did it. And that is a wonderful example. So Ordinary Angels, yeah. Go, take your hankies, have a little weep.
I actually didn't. I was so prepared, and it didn't... I teared up. I had something in my eye. But it wasn't... I was expecting, like, full-on Miss You Already vibes, sobbing into whatever's closest.
But I try not to do, like, really, really cry in screening. So I was sat next to Charles Gant, you know, I didn't want to embarrass myself, even though he's a friend.
I was sat next to Charles Gant for The Fall Guy. And
oh, funny. Big shout out to Charles Gant today, our screening buddy. But I just quietly sniffed, I think. But if I'd have been at home with a glass of wine, I probably would have been bawling.
Oh, yeah. The gin would have set me off for sure.
Well, Rhianna, it's always such a pleasure to speak to you. Thank you so much for joining Girls on Film. And is there anything else that you shared a little bit about what you're up to, but anything else you want to leave us with where the listeners can find you?
I am going to be on the BAFTA TV podcast, which is coming out soon, hosted by Alex Zane, just kind of talking about the nominations. So yes, have a listen.
Will do. And I'm off to Cannes, so I'll see you on the other side.
Oh, have an amazing time.
Thank you very much. I'm sure I will.
See you soon.
That was Rhianna Dillon. There's Still Tomorrow and Ordinary Angels are in UK cinemas now. The Fall Guy comes out on May the 2nd, 2024. My next guests are behind the initiative Cinema for Gaza, the charity auction for medical aid for Palestinians. It was founded by three film critics, Hannah Flint, Leila Latif and Sophie Monks Kaufman, who've all been on Girls on Film in the past. They teamed up to launch the auction with publicist Hannah Farr, as well as filmmakers Julia Jackman and Helen Simmons. The auction raised over £260,000 for Medical Aid for Palestinians, or MAP, a charity currently working in Gaza to provide immediate medical aid to those in great need. Lots came from all over the world, including a bedtime story read by Tilda Swinton, posters signed by Jonathan Glazer, and, one I really wanted, Annie Lennox's handwritten lyrics of the 1983 Eurythmics hit Sweet Dreams. On a rather smaller level, I also threw my hat into the ring with a personalised film critic masterclass. Now the auction is over, two of the team found the time to join us on Girls on Film. Here is Julia Jackman and Helen Simmons. Massive congratulations on Cinema for Gaza. Incredible work.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Before we go into talking about that, I wanted just to introduce you to the listeners. So, Julia, can I start with you? Can you tell them a little bit about yourself and your work?
Hi, I'm Julia Jackman, and I am a filmmaker. And Helen is a producer who worked with me on my debut feature. We made a film called Bonus Track, which is based on a story created by the lovely actor Josh O'Connor and written by Mike Gilbert. And it is a coming-of-age love story set in the 2000s, sort of a goofy Y2K comedy.
And Helen, I know you've worked on lots of things that I'm aware of, but do you want to tell the listeners a couple of them?
Yeah, so I'm Helen Simmons, and I'm a producer and a writer. Obviously, Bonus Track is coming out really soon, which is super exciting. And I also was one of the producers on a film called Horde, which comes out next month. And as a writer, I had a film at Berlin this year called Last Swim.
I haven't seen Bonus Track yet, but I can't wait to see it. And, well, we love Horde on Girls on Film. We're going to be talking more about that. But just to say congrats on that. Now, I've given the listeners a little bit of background on Cinema for Gaza, but I'd love to speak to you both and find out how it came about, how you both got involved with the other wonderful women who put their heads together and came up with this really, really important action for a very important cause.
Well, we had been vaguely aware of each other and friendly, obviously. Helen and I were friends, and we all essentially just kept bumping into each other at protests. And at some point, I think we'd all been feeling so horrified and helpless and wanted to contribute in whatever way that we could.
Yeah.
And so we formed a small WhatsApp group, basically.
Yeah. The power of WhatsApp. We were trying to think, how could we actually utilize our skill sets and our relationships and do something that was practical and was giving practical humanitarian aid and raising money, and also trying to, in a small way, change the atmosphere in the industry, which had felt quite scary for people to say anything. And it was just after the Oscars that we'd started kind of formalising this, where obviously there was all the various discussions around Jonathan Glazer's speech. So I think it was kind of a dual approach to thinking, how could we try and do something for good? And like Julia said, not just feel helpless about it.
Exactly.
And the auction idea is a great one. Julia, tell me what it was like when the first contributions and offers of lots started coming in, because I want some more detail on this for the listeners if they're not aware, because some incredible stuff was put up for bid, wasn't it?
Yes, I think we were quite astonished, because this obviously had a very grassroots spirit and, started as, we imagined creating a space for solidarity, and we couldn't imagine how much it would have grown. And I think probably the moment when we realized it was growing a little bit more was when Tilda Swinton auctioned a bedtime story. And we thought, okay, this is starting to gather momentum. Another key element, though, is I think since we were pairing with Zara and Noor, who are amazing at MAP, I think that the work that they do pragmatic work on the ground, as well as trying to strengthen the local healthcare infrastructure, so very locally focused. They had such a strong infrastructure in place that I think that was a huge key part in what made it gather speed and momentum.
Helen, tell me more about some of the highest winning bids. What really got people excited?
I think the highest item in the end was the Annie Lennox lyrics, followed by possibly Joseph Quinn, his Zoom. Ollie Alexander was really high. Jonathan Glazer's posters were actually bought by Barry Jenkins and Lulu Wang.
Amazing.
Yes.
<Wow. laughs> Yes.
Lots of the film memorabilia ended up going for quite a lot of money, or TV, the Doctor Who items and things. So I think we definitely felt there were a lot of fandoms that kind of got excited by specific items from specific shows and films.
Well, I was pleased that my film critic masterclass went for £510.
Yes.
So it's not too
and
bad.
Thank you so much for donating. The winner is so excited.
Oh, well, that's so lovely. I can't wait to meet her. And it struck me that I'm sure, like a lot of people, I'd been sitting around thinking, how can I help? What can I do? And to have this opportunity for a lot of people in the industry, I think was really important. And it was a moment where we felt we could all come together. Can you talk to me a little bit more about that sense of community and unity, and how exciting was it to see everyone adding their stuff and putting their time behind this?
I don't think we actually expected. I certainly thought like the hardest work was going to be the sort of 2 weeks before we launched, where we were like finalizing everything, getting the items together, which must have been at that point like 25.
Yes.
Maybe 40 at max items.
Yes. And we were so pleased with that.
It went from being us reaching out to people reaching out to us. Like, it was quite literally a case of, having Del Toro in our Twitter DMs, or Susan Sarandon or Melissa Barrera on our Instagram DMs. It was very, like Julia says, grassroots. It had a life of its own by the end, and it had such a kind of broad range of people donating so many different things from so many different parts of the industry and the world.
Yes, that was a really heartening element of it, is how international it became. Obviously we're all based in the UK. I am Canadian, and in fact in a cabin in the mountains right now. But yes, I don't know about you, Helen, but I was astonished and quite heartwarmed to see how many donors from all over the world, how many people were bidding from all over the world. It really made us feel less, we knew we weren't alone, but especially in the industry, it was incredible to see.
And as a group of women working together on this, it feels quite significant. I mean, I think later someone said in an interview, you get a bunch of really busy women and it's amazing what they can actually achieve together. Helen, would you like to speak to that, about how you all work together towards this common goal? There must have been such a sisterhood there.
Yeah, I mean, it was just, we sort of got to a point where so many things were coming in and we were just sort of doing shifts. And especially if people are in different time zones or had different work patterns, it would be like, okay, I've done 4 hours, like I'm handing over, somebody else take over for 4 hours. Or it was a bit of a marathon that we all helped each other get through with, and tried to sort of celebrate the wins and also focus ourselves on why we were doing it. I think I personally, I felt like there've been so many months of just feeling so depressed and saddened by everything. And you sort of, you don't know what to do with that other than go and march or, you know. And so I think we all kind of had this built up reserve of anger that we poured into productivity doing this. And I feel like that carried us. And then we all crashed a bit as soon as it finished.
Oh, no wonder you're in a cabin in the mountains, Julia. You need to
Well, it hasn't been a retreat per se, because, which, you know, in the best way, because this became, I think, as Helen said, this was feeling very, quite rightly, all encompassing anyway. You know, just what, this is the first, you know, live streamed utter bombardment that we've ever seen, and the fact that it's still happening is inconceivable. And this, you know, this fundraiser was so heartening, but such a small part, and obviously it has a knock-on effect. And, you know, MAP, everyone's work isn't done, and calling for a permanent, an immediate ceasefire, and continuing to do that is going to be the thing that allows these funds to do their maximum work. And so there's actually been a lot of knock-on effects. We've been communicating with groups over there on the ground, and, you know, when you have an international reach, you know, people in Gaza have been reaching out. You know, they've heard of the work that we're doing, and they're reminding us that it's just not over, you know.
Helen, how do people contribute if they haven't already? I presume, obviously, they can still contribute through the Cinema for Gaza website.
Well, our auction page is now shut, but you can obviously donate to MAP separately at any time. We're talking about future events and things that we can do, because I think, we were all kind of astonished at how big our platform grew in a short space of time, so we don't want to kind of let that go to waste. So we're still thinking about other ways that we can draw attention to Palestinian filmmakers' work or raise more money, you know, just thinking about what can we do now that we have this kind of small organization that's just formed.
Thank you so much, and please thank your colleagues as well for everything they've done, because we're just so in awe of what you've all achieved. And I'm sure our listeners will be contributing if they haven't already. You've probably been too busy to watch anyone else's films, but I wanted to end by asking, is there anything you would recommend to the listeners, kind of from a, you know, a female-focused feminist perspective, that you've managed to catch, whether it's on TV or in the cinema?
I had nothing to do with making it, but I did really love Horde by Luna Carmoon. I thought it was incredible. I haven't had much time to see anything recently. I loved Past Lives, but I think that's a bit old news by now.
Well, that one, our film of the year at the Girls on Film Awards, so I couldn't agree with you more. And Horde, as I mentioned, all the girls on film team have seen Horde, and we just fell in love with it massively. So, Helen, best of luck with that release.
Thank you.
It used to take me longer to remember Mother's voice. I can hear her again.
Boy, what are you playing at?
I can smell a memory.
You're a funny little biscuit.
I've come to realise grief will never heal over time.
Did anything spring to mind for you, Helen?
I'm going to see Abigail on Tuesday, which I'm very excited about, with Melissa in the starring role, and I'm a big horror fan, so I'm very excited about that. And I'm sure once I've seen it, I will also rave about it. But that's my upcoming.
Helen, can I come with you? Because I get scared if I watch these things on my own. But,
yes, come back from Melissa the cabin Barrera. And we can go.
Yes.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, thank you both so, so much for spending the time today to talk about your amazing work on all levels. And best of luck with the rest of the work you do with cinema.
Thank you so
thank
much.
Thank you so much.
I'm feeling woozy now.
That was Julia Jackman and Helen Simmons. Abigail is in cinemas now, as you heard, and Horde is out in UK cinemas on the 17th of May 2024. Keep your eyes peeled for bonus track. You can support Cinema for Gaza by buying a t-shirt or a tote bag before 7th of May 2024, where 100% of the proceeds go to MAP. Find details in the show notes. Finally, to review a couple of upcoming films for your diary, I'm pleased to welcome to the podcast Cece Peng.
Thanks so much, Anna, for having me. I'm excited to be here.
Oh, well, we're really glad to have you on. I've been sort of seeing your work around and about the last few years. Can you tell the listeners more about what you do?
Yeah, I'm a film writer and I'm a film programmer as well. So I've written for Dazed, Little White Lies, ID, GQ, mostly magazine writing. I've been really enjoying doing interviews mostly with directors and stars. And in film programming, I've been working with Cine Screen, who are a film collective that program East and Southeast Asian cinema across London. We're going to program something on ecology that's coming up in a few months. So watch out for that. And I'm working with Queer East to lead a mentorship program for young emerging critics at the moment. And Queer East is a festival for queer East and Southeast Asian cinema.
Fantastic. And how would people find out more about that?
Please check our Queer East website or Queer East Instagram, and we'll be producing a digital zine with all the writers and the emerging critics' writings, and there'll be more information on how you can access that soon.
That sounds like an absolutely brilliant initiative. We support that fully on Girls on Film. So let's move on to a couple of films that we've both seen that I'd love to talk about. Rose Glass's Love Lies Bleeding. We did an interview with her not long ago at Glasgow Film Festival. I loved it. I'd love to get your take on this film, Cece.
I loved it. I saw it in Berlin and it was after like a long day. I'd seen maybe like three other films already and I was like, okay, I really hope this one is good. It was like the final film of the day. And it just like blew me and my friend away and we were kind of gripping onto the seats. It was so visceral and bodily. I actually interviewed Rose Glass and we just had a really fun conversation and kind of talking about the phallic symbols of guns versus like the vaginal landscapes with a crack in the earth. And she was completely like, yeah, this is exactly how I saw it, which was really fun to see when you see it come together in the film.
It's great, isn't it, when you speak to a filmmaker and you're all on the same page. And yeah, she's just such a visionary film director, actually, I think.
So where did you appear from?
Oklahoma.
I've never been anywhere but here.
What were you doing with that big girl?
Get a lot of crazy-ass foreigners, mostly. How's it going, guys?
And Kristen Stewart, I think, is tremendous in this. What did you think of her performance?
So funny, which I think we don't really see her be that funny in films usually. And when Rose and I were speaking, she was like, you know, Kristen's really funny in real life as well. So it was really nice to see her have that kind of more playful element on screen.
That's a really good point. Yeah, she is really, really sort of dryly funny, isn't she? For me, there are many things that are refreshing about this film. I mean, it's a thriller, but obviously it centres on two women who are falling for each other in a crime sort of drama setup as well. I mean, what did you find refreshing about the way that it plays with genres and gender as well?
I think what was really refreshing was this kind of anti-male gaze element of kind of, you see the reverse shot of Kristen Stewart looking at Katie O'Brien kind of in the gym, which you usually expect with like Megan Fox and on a car with some man looking at her. And in this, obviously, it's flipped on its head. And I think with the crime thriller element, I loved how camp it was. It really reminded me of Showgirls by Verhoeven, which was an inspiration to Glass, and also of like Wild at Heart and kind of like this 80s Americana vibe, and how that kind of completely infiltrates the chaos, and it's the perfect setting for it as well.
I think there's all really good touch points for our listeners, definitely. I mean, if people haven't seen it yet, I think they'd be really time to see it now.
The excitement in the air is palpable. The atmosphere is electric. A celebration of history in the making.
What is this place? You're looking pretty good in there. There's some pretty serious lines going.
Yeah?
Why don't you want me working for your dad?
Well, he's a psycho.
What I really liked was the kind of use of close-ups throughout on kind of different bodies. And, you know, obviously Katie O'Brien is also a bodybuilder and works in martial arts. And the way you kind of see the strength in her body, and obviously then this is like amplified by the more kind of magical realist elements during the close-up, I won't give too much away. And then you kind of see Kristen's body during the sex scenes and how that's like a desiring body. And then
you see the violent body of the body after injury and kind of the gruesomeness of it. And all of these close-ups really build a sense of the visceral, especially in the cinema.
Beautifully put. Thank you, Cici. So I think we will both highly recommend Love Lies Bleeding.
They found a body.
Looks like you've got your hands full.
You'll regret this.
We'll just need to fight back.
I'm gonna tell them everything you ever did.
FBI, open up.
Are you threatening me?
Yep.
Well, that was really stupid, honey.
Looking further ahead, we've both seen an intriguing film starring Léa Seydoux called The Beast. She plays three roles in Bertrand Bonello's ambitious century-spanning French drama, kind of a sci-fi twist. I mean, where do you start with this film? What genres would you put it in?
Oh, it's like melodrama, romance, sci-fi. It actually, yeah, I just thought it was completely genre bending. And I read the Henry James novella that it was based on, and it's a completely interesting reversal because it's from Gabrielle's perspective instead of Louis, so Léa Seydoux's character. And you kind of follow Léa Seydoux through like these three different lifetimes. The time span is huge, but to see her maintain kind of this essence of her character being really anxious and being really fearful of love throughout is a really clever driving force. And it also feels very modern compared to the book.
It does feel really modern. And so if people don't know the Henry James connection, it might be quite a surprise to them because, as you say, it does feel actually very relevant.
This is the first time I've done this. How does it go?
En purifiant votre ADN, vous avez déjà posé de vos vies antérieures. Vous nettoyez les traumatismes dont vous avez hérité depuis des siècles.
De tous.
It could be very dangerous to bring someone back to who they were a few years before.
I thought Léa Seydoux, when she's a model in LA, trying to figure out her place, and she's fabulously successful living in a groundless place, but still desperately lonely. And I thought that was really vivid. I really liked that.
I love that. I actually really love George MacKay's performance because I think it changed. He tonally changed in that segment to kind of do this over the top performance. And it felt very much like him playing with himself, him playing with us as the audience to call kind of to the artificiality of this construct, whereas Léa Seydoux kind of remained more real. So seeing them together was this kind of jarring construct that I thought Bonello pulled off really well. I think actually that was my favorite segment of the film compared to the other two settings.
Yeah, I didn't like the sort of post-apocalyptic future as much as the other two, definitely. And that's interesting about George MacKay. I thought it was a really interesting idea to have a kind of American incel character. This is another way that the film is, it feels very relevant to now. I mean, I'm mixed on this one, but I would say absolutely watch it. As you say, it does a really interesting thing by twisting the sort of vision and making it more from the female point of view, which is something to be celebrated, I think.
Yeah, definitely.
What is stronger? Your fear or your love for me?
Because you think I love you. There must be beautiful things in this chaos.
Bonello is a really interesting director. I think, you know, the film affords such a sense of freedom throughout this kind of movement through time, which you rarely see. And also it's very daring in terms of genre. And he actually works in a very specific way. I read somewhere that he actually wrote 20 drafts of the script. He doesn't like improvisation on set. Everything kind of happens very much like the way he plans it out to be, which I find surprising because you can't really imagine a film like this just like written and this is like how it will come out. Once you watch it, I feel like you have a sense that, okay, so he kind of went on a crazy detour and decided that this would be the final result.
Quite trippy, isn't it? But a very planned trip. Really interesting. Well, thank you for sharing your views on that. Is there anything else that you are working on that you'd like to share with the listeners?
Yeah, I'd love to talk about Queer East a bit. Queer East Festival is finished, but it's been really great. There's been many interesting features on show. I think I'd love to talk about kind of the archival works that have been shown this year, which were The River by Simon Leung, which kind of demands to be seen in a cinema, considering that Simon Leung is a Taiwanese new wave filmmaker, for those who don't know his work. And his films are very silent. There's maybe like 10 lines throughout the whole film, but it's still quite narratively driven. And the images are just so clear, precise. And there's, in the film, the main character develops this kind of neck problem, and he's like twitching his neck constantly, and it's kind of symbolic for his kind of repression within the family, this kind of queer unspokenness. And as I looked around the cinema, everyone's necks started twitching. I could see so many hands reach for their necks, and I just love how sensory his cinema is and how it has to be seen with other people. And then another film that's coming is Bye Bye Love, which is just fantastic. It's a film from the 60s. It's a Japanese avant-garde new wave film, and it was discovered in a warehouse in 2018. Everyone thought it was lost, but it's kind of this gender fluid film between these two characters who are like Bonnie and Clyde. But the way you see they handle kind of their different kind of gender identities is like in a way where they just don't really care at all. And that's kind of utopic in a sense that we just shouldn't really care, and we should just mold to each other in a non-gendered way, which is more utopic than many queer films I've seen now. So to think that the 70s and the 60s were giving more is quite an interesting look.
Cece, thank you so much for joining Girls on Film. It's been wonderful to have you on.
Thanks so much for having me, Anna.
That was Cece Peng. The Beast is in UK cinemas on the 31st of May 2024. Love Lies Bleeding is in UK cinemas on the 3rd of May 2024. And also out on that day is the film Nezu, Sudad Kardan's film about a young girl in Damascus. It's a really moving, charming watch that blends feminist fairy tale with real life drama. Check it out. Girls on Film is an HLA production, brought to you by executive producer Hedda Lorne Archbold, producer Charlotte Matheson, audio editor Eliana J. Hamer. I'm Anna Smith. Thank you for listening. To hear more from Girls on Film, subscribe to our monthly newsletter, where we share exclusive screening opportunities and film recommendations with our community. There's a sign-up link in the show notes, or you can email us at girlsonfilmsocial@gmail.com to be signed up. And please consider supporting us on Patreon so we can continue to amplify women's voices in film. You can find those details in the notes too. We'll be back soon when I'll be giving you an update from the Cannes Film Festival 2024.
Some of my memories are vivid and some more like dream. They dip and dive.